2 years ago, an established science writer and journalist set out on a journey to explore what many call the UFO community. With the goal of giving it an anthropological look through first-person interaction and experience, Sarah Scholes explored the world around Area 51, visited the famed UFO Watchtower, scoured the darkest depths of the Internet Underground, ventured down the hallways of the Pentagon, interviewed skeptics, believers, and those in the middle, and yes, one of her interviews was even yours truly, which was all about the recent developments in the land of all things UFOs. The result of her exploration is now published in a more than 240-page book entitled They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. Released just 1 week ago, it's already received praise from Quartz, Publishers Weekly, and Booklist. But as with any book that shows healthy skepticism about the unknown, it also comes with a bit of controversy. Sarah steps into the Black Vault to share her journey. Who did she talk to? What did she see? As a science writer and journalist, how does she now feel about the topic after she immersed herself into the UFO community? Stay tuned. You're about to take a journey inside the Black Vault. That's right, everybody. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and taking this journey inside the Black Vault with me. I'm excited about today's show because Sarah Scholes is joining me. Sarah, it is nice to see you. Thanks for joining me on this.
Sure. Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure, and it's good to have you here. Congratulations on your book. It was released about a week ago. And obviously already creating some waves here with the reviews that you've gotten already, the praise that you've gotten, I should say, the good reviews. So congratulations for that. How's it been? A little busy the last week?
Yeah, a little bit of running around. It's always a little weird, you know, to, you know, spend a bunch of time typing away on something and then have it actually be in the world. So yeah, it's exciting and busy and stressful and good, so all the things books should be, I guess.
Yeah, no, it is. Stressful's a good word for it. I mean, it I don't think, if you've never written a book, I think people largely don't realize how much goes into it and how much time and how much effort. Obviously, I went through a couple things that you did for the book, how much traveling you did, how many people you talked to. I was excited to be asked to be interviewed by you and wound up in the book. So hopefully I said something worthwhile and I appreciate that interview. But again, I think that people don't largely realize how difficult writing books actually are. And this actually, I want to point out really quick, this isn't your first one. You've been writing for a long time as a science writer, as a journalist, but not your first book either. You wrote a biography on Dr. Jill Tarter from SETI, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, a few years ago. It came out in 2017. I was, Jill Tarter, who's the inspiration for the main character in the movie Contact, was like my childhood hero. And then when I thought about writing a book, I thought I wanted to get into the topic that had interested me most for the longest amount of time, which was SETI and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So that was super fun to work on and also exciting and busy and stressful and all the other stuff like this one.
I got to work with the SETI Institute on a couple shows I had produced for History Channel and Discovery Channel. And one of my biggest regrets, even though I didn't have any control over it, is I never got to meet Dr. Tarter. Obviously got to meet Dr. Seth Shostak, who's been a guest on this show, quite a few other amazing scientists up there. And I think in kind of like the UFO world, which I know we're going to be getting into with your newest book, But I think they get very much a bad rap, and I don't think it's deserved. I have a lot of respect for them up there. I've said it quite a bit. I know that, again, they get a little bit of a bad rap, but I've always regretted not being able to meet Dr. Tartar. So I'm a little jealous that you got to spend so much time with her. I watched an onstage presentation that you guys did together, like a Q&A session, and then I saw Dr. Shostak was the one that I believe hosted that. So very cool. Congratulations on that as well, because it's a very fascinating topic that I think people very much underestimate. One last thing I want to kind of point out about your background so people understand that you didn't just dive into the UFO community and write a book about it. You have a very amazing and eclectic background when it comes to an intellectual infrastructure on understanding a lot of this stuff. Not only, and I'm going to read it so I don't screw this up, but your work has appeared in Wired, Popular Science, Slate, Scientific American, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, Motherboard. So you're writing for quite a few different mainstream publications. You were an associate editor for Astronomy Magazine. You were a public education officer at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in West Virginia. You have an MFA in creative writing and from Cornell, and you have a BA in astrophysics from Agnes Scott College. Why I want to point that out is because you obviously have a background in these topics. And so you have that science background, not only as a writer, but then starting to tackle the UFO topic a little bit. So let me kind of dig in a little bit, if I can. Why did you go from essentially writing about those more hardcore textbook scientific articles and then lean towards the UFO topic here in the last couple of years, because you've written a few articles on UFOs? How did you bridge that? Where did that come from?
Yeah, it started a little bit before even the UFO part of it, I would say, where for a while I was writing mostly hard science news, astronomy news, physics news, stuff like that. And then I started to get more interested in the people and processes and kind of the stories behind the story of, you know, how did people discover this neutron star, or what were the policies behind the creation of this radio telescope or something. And so in a lot of ways, you know, meta science or narrative science, stuff like that. And so then I really didn't think very much about UFOs until December 2017, like I think a lot of people. And then I read the famous and infamous New York Times article and I was fascinated by it. I thought it was really amazing sounding, and I also had some doubts. So then I just kind of started to point by point try to get evidence to support or evidence to refute the things that were in that article. And kind of in the early process of that, I started to meet people. I hadn't met you yet back then, but I started to interview people who had been researching UFOs for much longer. I mean, I was a total new kid on the block. And when I started talking to people, I realized that there was this whole world of knowledge that I hadn't had access to or interest in before this. And I became really interested in what it was like from kind of the same perspective that I'd started looking at traditional science.
Did you have a idea about UFOs at that time in December of 2017 when you read the New York Times article? I mean, did you have any preconceived notions? Did you say, hey, this is all bunk, or you've been fascinated since you were a kid? I mean, what was your background in it, if any?
Sure. I mean, I think I took the traditional take that a lot of scientists have, which I don't agree with now after doing this reporting, which is just to totally dismiss it, basically, to start with, and to say, you know, that there's no way that these reports are true, and so I really have no interest in it. And so I just really, yeah, I had that conclusion about it without having any evidence about it, which I would say now was not very scientific of me. And so it took a little bit for me to get over that, and also to you know, when I started telling people that I was working on this book about UFOs after I'd been writing about the Large Hadron Collider or whatever, it took a little bit for me to get over myself, which I think is important for people coming from my world to admit, probably.
So I want to get into, I don't want to jump the gun, but you said something really interesting that you had, what it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, a preconceived notion to just dismiss it. But then as time went on, you realized what? Was there more to it, or did you just maybe gain respect for it but still don't believe the phenomena is real? How did that shift as you were researching the New York Times article, but then also your book?
Yeah, I think from a basic perspective, I don't think that my own conclusion about what UFOs are or are not has fundamentally changed. I know that, it's not good to just jump to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and I would say that I haven't gotten on that bandwagon. But I think I realized something that was a quote that actually Chris Rutkowski, who I assume a lot of your listeners are familiar with, mm-hmm. had said to me early on, and he also came from the world of astronomy, which was that there's this interesting thing where very credible people see incredible things. And I think I realized that whatever my conclusions about what those incredible things were or weren't, like, it was indisputable that people saw things that they themselves couldn't explain. And also that there was all this, you know, history and politics and like the research you do into government documents and mm-hmm. programs and things like that, that I just I hadn't cared enough before that to get into it. And that was ill-informed of me, I think, was my conclusion.
Well, kudos to you. I wish more people cared to look into it, even if they came out of the research that they do solo or by themselves, or even write a book, decide to dig in. Even if they come out the other end saying, no, I don't believe in it. I have a lot of respect for people who do dig in for themselves and discover those answers. So again, kudos to you, because even though we may not fully agree on the topic, I know from talking to you and being somebody that you really spent a lot of time and care and genuine interest. I mean, I've done quite a few interviews in the last 23 years, and that person, you know, they're like, okay, question one, what do you think of this? And then, you know, they scribble some notes and then they go on and do a article about something else the next day. And I will say this from personal firsthand experience, you cared about what I was telling you, you know? And so I can only speak for myself on this because I'm not sure how all the other conversations went. But I wish there were more journalists like you that took the time. Again, it doesn't matter what you conclude in the end, but the fact that you did the work and really, you know, showed it respect, I in turn respect that. I want to ask you about the ATIP topic, because that's obviously what got you into this, and you're not alone, not only from a journalistic standpoint, but there's a lot of people that we would say in the UFO community, pretty much they think ufology started in 2017, and even though that frustrates me, it is what it is. But there's a lot of people that have come aboard looking at this in different angles. After you read that New York Times article prior to deciding to do your book, did you feel that they were spot on with that story? Or what did you start to see unfold as you started picking it apart and trying to essentially fact check for yourself?
Yeah, I started to see what I saw as some holes in not necessarily the evidence that the writers had, because I still don't know what documents or information they had access to, but holes in what we, the readers, had to be able to prove to ourselves that what they were saying was true. Things like the line in the story about altering buildings in Las Vegas to be able to house and research materials from crashed UAP. I noticed in a sentence like that, that the evidence that they had in the story was just that someone said that.
Yeah. Where is the evidence?
You know,
on that
I don't
one?
Have a way to verify that, right? But the biggest thing for me was talking to the Pentagon, and I really started to be suspicious of the story when I did go talk to Major Audricia Harris, who I know you spoke to also. I actually went there before I published the first story that I wrote about it and talked to her in person. They let me in, which is pretty cool. And she was very adamant that they had not released the two videos that had come along with the story, and that started my, you know, spidey senses tingling. And we all know that people in the federal government, you know better than anyone, are able to use kind of weaselly language to not be totally clear about what they're saying. So it wasn't really clear to me for a long time mm-hmm. what she meant by that. But yeah, those were kind of the things that got me starting to think, like, maybe this is something that I want to dig into a little deeper.
And so really quick, so you physically went to the Pentagon and met with Major Harris, who I believe now is a lieutenant colonel. So kudos to her for her promotions. But at the time, Major Harris, so you went to the Pentagon to meet her?
I did. Yeah, it was too fast a turnaround for a magazine budget to be able to send me there. So I had a new airline credit card with a bunch of points miles. So I just went and lost all my points. But
You know what? That's another point that you care to actually go and speak to someone face to face. I believe I don't remember when we actually first met, but you were pursuing a story angle that obviously I was really intrigued by also, that Major Harris was saying, I didn't get to go to the Pentagon, sadly, I'd love to go, but that the videos just weren't released, as you just said. Obviously, the red flags for people who were looking at that just were starting to fly at that point. Did you ever get the indication when it came to that the Pentagon or Major Harris or just the government as a whole was not being honest about that aspect to it?
No, I stand by that aspect right now. I think that it's a little unclear what everybody means by release, and what someone in the Pentagon means when they say we released or didn't release is maybe different from what the dictionary definition is. Mm-hmm. But what she told me from the beginning was that those videos had gone through part of the pre-publication and security review, mm-hmm. but had not been authorized for public release like they would need to be if they were to be officially released to the media. And as far as the documentation I've seen, that to me appears to hold up today.
Yeah, and they haven't wavered on that. They have wavered on the, did ATIP study UFOs? And from what I understand, if the Pentagon will ever get back to any of us, that there are more statements coming, but we have no idea what they are. I know Vice News, MJ Banias has talked about that. I know Tim McMillan has talked about that, all journalists, freelance and so on. We're all hearing that more statements are coming, but we have no idea when. But to the videos, yeah, they have not wavered on that at all. What other discrepancies did you see as you were continuing to dig into the story?
Another one that seems to both hold up and still be confusing is Luis Elizondo's role in the program, which that was one of the things I set out trying to confirm with the Pentagon from the beginning. And while they would always confirm that he worked for the Defense Department, they wouldn't ever say to me that he had worked for this program or been the director of this program. And since then, they've come out and said that he had no responsibilities related to the program. He disputes that. And, you know, when we have these conflicting statements, it's hard to know where things stand.
You were talking about how they pick and choose their words. That really seemed like they were picking and choosing their words as time went on. At first they said there were no responsibilities, and then later added assigned responsibilities. You know, and at this point, I have no idea what to believe. I've said that a couple times now. I don't know what mm-hmm. to believe. As a journalist, what does your gut tell you, if I may ask?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard with that, and with the does it study UAP, does it not study UAP, which is one of the other things I was trying to get to the bottom of and gotten full 360 on answers, I think. My gut doesn't have a conclusion about what it all means exactly, except that I think, they surely by now have the ability to clear it up on yeah. either side. The people yes. at the Stars Academy could clear it up, or the Pentagon could clear it up. It's not actually a mystery. There are answers. And like UFOs might be a mystery, ATIP is not a mystery. It's a government program. And so it must be in everyone's best interest somehow to leave it a little bit ambiguous. And I'm not sure what those interests are exactly, But that was really the only conclusion I could come to.
I 100%, you said it much better than I ever could. Both sides could settle this debate once and for all, probably pretty easy. And that also boggles my mind, is why not? And the where I'm left is very much where you are. I have no idea anymore. You know, ask me a year ago, I would have started placing bets in Vegas on certain things going the way that I thought they were. And hey, you know, when you're wrong, thinking that you have it figured out happens in ufology all the time. But at this point, I mean, Mr. Elizondo told me he believes that by the end of this year, it will be cleared up. I don't know what that means.
That would be great.
Yeah, I'm with you, but it's just one of those, like, I have no idea what that means. Now, for the audience, too, because I want to point this out, I'm not just asking Sarah questions about ATIP out of the blue just because, you know, it makes it seem like I'm trying to pick on them. Sarah goes into great detail about her research into ATIP and all of these issues in her book, along with a lot of other stuff as well. So I don't want anybody to think I'm coming out of left field just starting to pick your brain on that. So with evidence, obviously you come from scientific background. How important is it to you, again, with that scientific background and also a journalist, to have hardcore evidence that seems to be lacking on some of these stories, i.e. there's a hangar in Las Vegas that was specially modified to house pieces of UFOs, and then they go on to something else with no evidence. How important is that hardcore evidence to this story?
To me, it's extremely important, and I think, especially coming out of, you know, the world's most journalistic outlet like that did, you're kind of supposed to undertake stories that you write as a journalist kind of with a scientific mindset of gathering the evidence, showing the evidence, and coming to conclusions. And obviously sometimes, like in stories dealing with national security, you can't show your whole hand of what you had, but I think to the extent possible, you should be able to give readers enough evidence to come to the same conclusion you did. And I don't think that happened here. And I think the reason it bothered me so much in this story was that if these things were true, there would be evidence that we should all be able to see for the hangar, for the, you know, the medical reports they mentioned about people who might have been physically affected by UAP. And even for things like the videos, where I can't remember if it was actually in the original story or not, but at least in some of the follow-up reporting that there was radar data. And obviously that's going to probably have some classification on it, but there is hard data. And so when you can't access that, it's frustrating to me at least.
Do you think your background kind of getting immersed in the SETI world prior to the UFO world, do you think that played a role in your views on UFOs, or did you just tackle this with a fresh start, seeing what you could find?
That's a good question. You know, the people in SETI, with exceptions, I think, like Seth Jostak, who I know you've had on, mm-hmm. A lot of times like to try to distance themselves from UFOs just because sometimes it's harder to get funding for your work if you're associated with things that other people associate with fringiness or something. But I think there's more overlap there than we really talk about. And working on the SETI book actually gave me a much simultaneously a much more optimistic and a much more pessimistic view of life in the universe, if we're talking about the extraterrestrial hypothesis for UFOs, which we should specify is not the only one out there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, SETI scientists talk about how many planets there are that could be habitable, which is true. I can't remember the latest exact numbers, but many, many zeros behind
them. The Drake equation calculation. There's too many variables, I think, that we can't answer on that one.
Yeah, it's...
but we just fill it in. So, we'll just take a guess.
Yeah. Who knows? About five. so there's a lot of reasons to be hopeful that the universe is full of lots of civilizations, but then I think it also gave me kind of a realistic expectation of the idea that maybe there's not so much out there. And I think, I mean, I guess kind of like UFOs, I came out maybe less certain of all of my conclusions than I had started with, which is probably a good place to be.
How could I phrase this? What do you think is missing to bridge where those scientists are saying, we're not going to touch that, meaning the UFO topic? What is missing? Is it just evidence, or is there truly a stigma behind it? And you don't have to name names, but scientists, whether it be with SETI or others that you interviewed, what are they lacking that keeps them from even entertaining UFOs as something that they should look at?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think the stigma is real. I have done a little bit of research. It's only in the book a little bit, but on a thing that sociologists call boundary work, which is where scientists kind of define what counts as science and what doesn't, to delineate who is legitimate and who is not, and that there are social consequences for disobeying those limits. And I think that's real. But I think they would get over those pretty fast if there were more of this hard evidence. I think it's hard for them, and understandably, I think, to take just witness reports as evidence.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we mostly see social scientists and historians and psychologists who are interested in it, and not the hard scientists.
I had somebody from Harvard University on that, David Aguilar, who is an amazing human being, one of my favorite humans on the planet, and just very, very intelligent, multiple backgrounds. And he said, to kind of sum it up, astronomers and those that have that expertise as a background, you don't want them looking into UFOs. And when he said that, it was very interesting, because it's like, that's not who they are. You know, they study the stars, they study the cosmos, they study the planets. Astrobiologists study, you know, their niche. But essentially, when it comes to UFOs and so on, that you want a certain type of person with a certain background looking into that. I always was fascinated by that, because we expect so much from scientists, meaning an astronomer who's looking for a faraway extraterrestrial signal. That, you know, that's a totally different niche than somebody who's saying, hey, look, there's a metal disc flying in the sky, you know, here on Earth. And even though he dismisses it, David was essentially saying that you want the correct backgrounds to research the correct topic. And so I was always intrigued by that. I don't know what your thoughts are, if you want to add anything to that, but I thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah, no, I should probably go listen to that interview. And I hadn't thought about it in exactly that way, but it definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
A UFO is not going to be a bunch of photons in a telescope, which is what astronomers deal with, and he's very right about that.
Yeah.
I don't know who does have the right background. Did he have ideas for who does have the right background?
I'm not sure. I'm looking at your doggy in the background. I don't know if
Sorry.
Actually... No, that's he or she.
She.
She, very, very cute. She put her head down right on the couch. It was very, very cute. I love my cat has made appearances. Some people have noticed, some have not. Behind me, he's opened the door. I'm an animal person, so I had to point that out.
Okay. Yeah.
So
she wanted to get famous on your podcast.
That's right. Well, she is just peeking around your shoulder. I love it. So she's right on. So with SETI, kind of moving on from SETI, but keeping with the scientific background, I should. I kind of lost my train of thought of where I wanted to go, because your dog threw me off. No, that's okay. That's okay. Let me switch gears a little bit. You obviously, in your book, you not only talked about your research into ATIP, scientific evidence, and so on and so forth, but you did a lot of traveling. I know you went to Area 51. Was that tied into the Storm Area 51 movement? Is that when you went out there?
No, actually, I did go out there for that, but I had already turned the draft of the book in when that happened. So this trip that's in the book was from October 2018.
So what were you aiming to find out there? I mean, for those who've never been there, I have. It's a whole lot of nothing surrounded by cows. I don't know if it's still that way. It's been years since I've been out there, but you literally run into cows in the middle of nowhere. But you get to a fence, you can't go anywhere. You get to a sign, you can't go anywhere. What was your intent? Did you just try and camp out to see something, or what were you looking for?
Yeah, I wanted to camp out and see if I saw something. I wanted to go to the town and meet. In the book, I talk about a guy named York Arnoux who runs the Dreamland Resort website. So I just kind of wanted to get a feel for the place. And I didn't necessarily expect to see anything. I thought I might just be camping for a few days, which was also fine with me. But I mean, yeah, it is a little underwhelming. I definitely almost hit a cow with my car in the dark.
So they're still roaming around out there. And
oh, yeah, very much. Yeah, but I mean, it's just, it's not even an exciting gate necessarily, right?
Yeah.
It's just a gate. I'm sure it would get exciting if you tried to cross it. But you know, we did see stuff. Actually, we saw some flare exercises, which I had never seen before. And so made me understand why people report those as flying saucers a lot, because they absolutely look like flying saucers. And we saw some kind of fleet of something, this like matrix of dots in the sky that was arranged in a very linear pattern, and all moved in unison, kind of appeared out of nowhere and then disappeared. So it was fun. I didn't learn any government secrets. But
well, let me back you up. The flare one, I kind of understand was maybe cool to see, but explainable. So you saw a formation of objects. Was it high? Was it low? Do you feel that it was just a test of or a flight pattern of something from Area 51, or was this well above a satellite string? What was it?
No, it was definitely suborbital, but pretty high, I think, based on the size of the lights. But yeah, it was kind of just rows and columns of a lot of little tiny white blinking lights that all moved together, and they would just kind of appear, and then they would be there for a while, all moving in unison and going away. And Jörg Arnu, the Dreamland Resort guy, suggested that these were maybe a fleet of drones flying in formation, but I don't know that. So
you saw a UFO, is what you're saying.
UFOs
multiple.
To me. Those were UFOs to me.
A fleet of UFOs. Perfect. See, I didn't know that you had seen that. Was that the trip that you went for your book, though?
Yes.
And is that in your book?
Yeah, when I went. Yes.
Okay. I went through as much as I could before the show. I just got it a couple days ago, but obviously didn't read that section, and I had to see if that was in there. So it's very, very cool. That's awesome. I'm not saying that's E.T., by the way. I'm just saying that that's cool that you saw some stuff out there, because I did not see
it is,
anything. No. I got intimidated out by the camo dudes in an SUV, but other than that, I didn't see anything. Where else did you travel for this book?
Let's see, I went to the International UFO Congress outside of Phoenix, went to the Roswell UFO Festival. I went a few times to the UFO Watchtower in Colorado, and then to Sunspot, New Mexico.
The UFO Watch, not to interrupt you, the UFO Watchtower, for those who don't know, can you explain exactly what that is?
Sure. It's a small tourist attraction in a place called the San Luis Valley, which is about 3 hours from Denver. It's this very large valley surrounded by two very large sub-mountain ranges, and it has very strange sand dunes right up against the mountains that look like they don't belong there at all. And then kind of right across the highway from those is a place called the UFO Watchtower, which was a place built by a rancher who was not a UFO believer at all at first and just needed to pay her mortgage and heard that people saw a lot of UFOs, so just built this platform and campground where people could come watch UFOs. And then gradually, she became a believer, and she gathered a lot of sightings in the sightings book, created a little museum, and it's kind of a community gathering place and a gathering place for people, interested people in UFOs who kind of come in off the highway.
And going to all those conferences, I've spoken at quite a few of them, and it can be an experience. Sometimes you meet a former NASA, engineer or scientist. Other times you meet someone who says that they've gone to Venus, and it's like this eclectic crowd of people. What was your experience like?
Yeah, pretty much exactly like that.
Yeah.
The International UFO Congress was the first one I went to, and I went in February 2018, so just right after I started looking into UFOs and ufology at all. And I think before I went, I didn't really have a sense of the diversity of opinions out there, that I think there was even a talk by a former NASA engineer while I was there. And then there were also people who wanted to help connect me to the exopolitical people who could, you know, I don't know, but just varying degrees of belief and, yeah, and evidence and skepticism and all that. And it was interesting to me that everybody came together at this place and mostly got along, which I think is great.
And I don't want to label you, but can I call you a skeptic? I mean, is that safe to say? I think is the right word. I don't want to offend you if that's not the right word.
No, I think that's a fair word. Okay. Let's not call me a debunker, but we can call me a skeptic.
You know, I always thought that the D word was kind of an insult, and I had Mick West on, and that's what he calls himself. And we actually had a conversation about it. I said, I never call anybody a debunker because I've always felt that it was a negative connotation. He's like, no. And we had this conversation. So anyway, that's why I always ask. I'm always sensitive to labels and stuff like that. So, okay. So being somebody who's very skeptical, you go to these conferences. Did you have an expectation before you went? And did you meet that expectation? Or what happened when you walked away? I mean, did you go, wow, this is kind of some craziness? Or did you see something that made you say to yourself, hey, maybe there is something here in between all this kind of craziness?
Yeah, I mean, I think in any kind of reporting, not just in UFOs, but if you're reporting on humans, you're pretty much always going to be interviewing people who are different from you, who've had different experiences, have different opinions. And I try to go into all of it, whether I'm talking about like a physics professor or someone who says they live in an underground alien army base. Just going into it in good faith, you know, and wanting to listen to and like value their experience, even if it's different than mine, because I'm just a person also. And I'm losing track of what the question was.
Well, just like how you walked away from it, you know, like how after meeting everybody, was there any sliver of anything that made you think there's really something to this, but you got to weed through the craziness? Or did you just say, hey, look, these are probably genuine people interested in something, but there's nothing there?
I don't think I'd come to a conclusion as far as the is it there-ness or not, but I did find everyone, at least in every audience member in general, attendee, to be very genuine and sincere. And what really stuck out to me, especially, I mean, at this point, it had been like a month and a half since I had started looking into this at all, that whatever I had thought about UFOs before, that people saw them and they affected people very deeply. And it wasn't just a few people, it was a lot of people. And so it was there as some kind of a phenomenon, whether I knew anything about what that was or not. And even if it was all misidentifications, like that doesn't really affect someone's experience of what it is if they can't identify it. So, yeah.
You're one of the rare people that have had a lot of interaction with the government on a topic like this. I mean, a lot of journalists, I call it copy and paste journalism. We saw it, especially in December of 2017, where, you know, they essentially quote the New York Times, but they didn't do a lot of original research for their articles. You were different. You really kind of dug in. With your dealings with the government, can you talk to me a little bit about that? I would say, I hope you would agree with this, but the decades long of the government just kind of dismissing this topic and really kind of getting caught and with their foot in their mouth a couple times. Do you have an idea of why that keeps happening? I mean, some things seem legit that they talk about. Other things, it's like, especially when they backtrack and change their press statements. Do you have any thoughts or theories on why they keep getting kind of caught up in this mess?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know exactly for now, but I know, you know, in the past, they haven't wanted to betray all of their interests or the sorts or what was motivating their interests because they didn't want people to give it more legitimacy. They wanted to delegitimize it. And so if people knew that they were paying attention, well, then if the government's paying attention, we should pay attention. And so, I mean, usually what happens in the past is happening now also. So chances are some version of that is true right now. And I think, I mean, what's hard for me to tell from the outside is how much of the obfuscation is just governments being governments, and they like to overclassify things and make things more secret than they need to be. And so it's hard for me to tell whether this is just more of the same or whether there's something more to it. But I mean, you document in your own book the lengths that, that they've gone to keep things quiet. And it is a good question. Why? Somebody else will have to write that book.
I struggle with it a lot because it's a very dangerous position to just immediately assume the government is lying to you when they talk to you. That's a very dangerous thing to say, even though I have devoted much of my life to investigating secrets and catching the government in lies. It's just a dangerous area to go to, and a lot of people do, and I don't recommend that. But the fact remains is that they do essentially lie sometimes about this topic, whether it be intentionally, whether it be malicious, whether it be just on accident. You know, we can put up arguments for both sides, but regardless, they're kind of in this mess. When it comes to the government's connection, yeah, in your experience being in the halls of the Pentagon, talking to a major who's a Pentagon spokesperson, when you look at that history, do you feel that this is probably explainable, but we don't know how? Or do you think that maybe deep down there could be something much more sinister than what they want us to believe?
I don't know if I know the answer to that question. I wish I did. But something I think about a lot, and I will leave it here without drawing an explicit connection, is other times when I've written about topics that have something to do with national security in some way, and I feel like I'm getting more information than someone should be giving me, and they're giving it to me on the record. Sometimes I just ask, why are you telling me this? You don't have to tell me this. And they say that it is in the U.S. interest to have information that scares our enemies out there about our capabilities, to have them know or think they know something about us. And I don't want to draw an explicit line for what that might mean here, but I think it's an interesting insight into the way that the government holds back or provides information to people. And I should add, unrelated to that, the Pentagon was very open with me for a long time. Like, I didn't get all the answers about the program, but Audrey Shaharis was happy to talk to me for a very long time. Susan Gao talked to me some for a while, not the whole time, but I did have fairly forthright conversations for a long time with them about this.
I think that's what also a lot of people that have never had experience talking to the Pentagon is that we often forget, me included, and I have talked to them, that they are human, and you try and acknowledge that they, you know, are not just dealing with you, with me, and 12,000 other UFO people that are bothering them, but also they deal with every other topic the Pentagon has to deal with at the exact same time. So I try and sympathize with that a little bit. Doesn't always work because you get frustrated. But I feel in the last like 6 months, maybe close to a year, something happened. They just are kind of closing up. And I'll pose the question to you, but I don't want to pry too much. I don't know if you're working on a story or not. But have you felt that since Major Harris left, and we don't have to name names because there's been a couple spokespeople involved here, do you feel that that openness and willingness to chat is still there? Or do you feel that maybe there's this kind of like step back going, hey, wait a minute, we got to be really careful here because this is getting a lot of attention. Are you pursuing stuff now to address that? If I can ask.
You may. I'm not actively pursuing any news stories at the moment. I do have a number of outstanding FOIA requests that I'll see in 2050 or whenever they come back. But I was trying to get You know, before the book went to print, I wanted to have the latest answers in there, the most up-to-date information possible. And so I had been speaking with people in the office after Major Harris left just to try to clear up things that seem so confusing and maybe expand the information, but at least like confirm or deny the information that we had received previously. And sometime last spring was when I sent my questions initially, saying, you know, my book is due in August. Can we get answers to these by then? And after I sent the questions, she responded a few times to say that it would be a while. And then at some point, they stopped responding
Maybe she thought August 2023. I don't know. To be fair,
Maybe.
Yeah,
it is Pentagon time.
Yeah, so. Government time. That's right. That's probably the short amount of time. You're definitely not alone. I hear that quite a bit here, that they're just not talking. And I try not to read into that, because, again, going back to the probably being overworked and dealing with a lot of stuff, and they're probably very tired of, I'll only speak for me, but very tired of me, because I am pushing, you know, and I generally don't take the first answer that they give me and keep pushing. So hopefully we'll get some kind of answers here. One of the other topics, did you deal, and this is in the media today, Skinwalker Ranch, Vice News did a piece where they revealed who the owner is. It's been kind of hush-hush. People have rumored about it, and I think the rumors were essentially true. But now the guy who owns Skinwalker has officially gone on the record and identified himself and so on. Did you deal with Skinwalker in your book or in your research?
I did, yeah. Well, partly, yeah. There's a chapter that's about Robert Bigelow's history of funding ufological projects, and then about his National Institute for Discovery Science and Skinwalker Ranch. It's not, it's just part of the chapter, so it's not the world's most in-depth history of it, but I do deal with it. And yeah, I was happy to see that story published today, to have the rumors confirmed. It'll be interesting to see what happens there.
In the research did you find connections between Skinwalker Ranch and ATIP? Because obviously that has been in the media a lot as well, but very controversial and disputed on whether or not it truly played a role or a small role, or it was the epicenter for ATIP, which I've seen that as well. Any thoughts on that, on what you had discovered?
Yeah, no, I tried to find a direct connection or something to refute a direct connection between the program and how much research was done there or wasn't, and I myself could never find a direct link. The things that I have seen are all, you know, people's claims about the varying degrees of involvement, but I don't have any firsthand documentation of that myself.
With your book, if you were to sum up why you wrote it, why did you write it?
That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah, why do we write any of these books? They're too hard.
Right. I think after I saw the ATIP story, I saw UFOs coming back into the news cycle in a way that I haven't seen, at least in my adult life. And it was clearly catching some kind of cultural nerve, like in addition to whatever you think about what ATIP was or the origin or reality of UFOs, kind of like people's sightings, you can't really dispute that people are very interested in it right now. And so I kind of wanted to understand the history of why people had been more interested in them when, and how that overlapped with international relations and politics and things like that. And then also the ways that people had looked at them historically and the ways they were looking at them now. And so I feel like each chapter kind of takes a look at UFOs as a different thing for different people. Like, sometimes they're a government secret, sometimes they're a conspiracy theory, sometimes they are a research project, sometimes they're spiritual, and just trying to tackle it from all angles, I guess, was the goal. Also, I mean, mostly I wrote the book to satisfy my own curiosity, but that was what I was curious about.
So far, how has the reaction been? Obviously, you've gotten a lot of praise from the professional reviewers. I went over a couple in the introduction. But obviously, the Twitterverse and social media platforms are across the board. It's not for the the lighthearted when you start reading what people throw at you. And what has the reaction been? And are you surprised, excited, let down? What how do you feel so far?
Yeah, I think the gamut of reactions is about what I expected. I think people in my world, in the world of science journalism, they seem to be interested in it from the perspective of maybe getting a little bit outside of the hard traditional sciences and just understanding something different and understanding why that's appealing, which I think is probably that's what interested me, so it makes sense. And I feel like of the people who I, interviewed and spoke to for the book, I think most people feel that they were portrayed accurately, or all people who I've spoken to, maybe I have yet to hear from some. And then, yeah, there's the usual Twitter controversies of, there's a lot of not liking the book on UFO Twitter, but because I had written UFO articles before, I kind of knew that.
Yeah.
Going in.
The people that throw the harshest criticism, I guarantee, are the ones that don't read what you wrote. You know, they just have these preconceived notions. I get that a lot myself, and saw someone throw some pretty harsh criticism my way for an interview I did, and openly admitted he didn't even listen to it. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Why are you criticizing if you didn't even listen? So I'm always sympathetic for those to those that just get bombarded by kind of some silliness. There was one post that I had read, and I had sent it to you because I wanted to, with respectfully, razz you a little bit. That there was an article that came out, and the quote was, and I'm going to read it here: "UFO belief," Scholes writes, "is not just similar to religion, it is one. It is a New Age religion," she writes. "It's not a science, it's not a hobby, it's a faith system." Now, that's okay if you were to feel that way. I would respectfully disagree, we'd have a conversation. But I remembered reading that section of the book. I had read it earlier that day, and so I kind of cross-referenced it to make sure I didn't misread it. And then I wrote you about it and said, okay, is this accurate? And that was the criticism that was posted. They didn't necessarily fire a shot at you, but they made that quote being the only one that they pulled from the article, making it seem like you were saying all of ufology was essentially a religion and faith with absolutely no science. Can I ask, is that how you feel, or was that maybe a little bit misconstrued?
No, that's not how I feel. I think that that quote from the article was taken a little bit out of context. I do think that a certain segment of people who are interested in UFOs, maybe what we could call UFO true believers, do interact with things in that way where they know for sure and nothing you can say will change their mind because they already believe. And I think, unless you're hurting someone, that's fine.
Yeah.
People just believe what they want, but I don't think, I definitely don't think that's all of ufology at all. And in fact, very early on in the book, I talk about how that was what I thought of ufology going in, and finding out that lots of the people I was meeting were not like that at all, and kind of did more agnostic research, and maybe they had their own personal feelings about UFOs, but they were still able to do really solid research and things, and those people like yourself interest me more. And so actually in the book, I don't write about true belief very much. I don't think they were not most of the people I interviewed for the book. And so I guess in conclusion, I do think that about part of ufology. I don't think about all of it, and yeah, probably not even the majority of it. Yeah.
And I appreciate you letting me ask that question, because I did want to clear it up, because I don't feel it's a fair criticism. That isn't how I read it in the book. But when you only read that, you go, really? She says that? So I appreciate clearing it up. And I fully agree with you. Yeah. There is a aspect to the field of ufology that is very religion-like. There's also an aspect that's very cultist. I mean, sadly, there is a second. They found their way to Twitter, all of them, but very much a cult-like mentality. It's not the majority of people out there, but I would definitely argue they are the loudest, sadly. I mean, that if you say anything that goes against their beliefs, then you are going to, you know, get the wrath of Twitter. And that is really a sad aspect to ufology. And it kind of frustrates me to see that, because someone like you, who is, again, with that skeptical but scientific background, but is curious and fair, you have adjusted your beliefs slightly, it sounds like, from when you first started to now, which, again, I have a lot of respect for. We may not agree, again, with all of this stuff, but you took the time to look at it. What would you say at this point, now that you've done all the research that you have and that you have talked to all the people that you have, what would you say to those journalists and even scientists that just go, nah, all that stuff, it's a waste of time, I don't want to deal with it? What would you say to them at this point, if anything, about the UFO community? Stay away.
I think I would. Yeah, don't get on Twitter.
Stay off Twitter.
I mean, I think I would say what I would say about most groups of people, which is that we should give them a shot and go into each interview or interaction you have with people with a fresh mindset, open to new conclusions, open to new ideas, and also that. Just because, like, the hard sciences are not the only things worth covering in the world. Only things with columns of numbers and I don't know what else, plots, things like that, are not the only things worth covering. Arguably, more people care about UFOs than care about particle accelerators, and that, just by virtue of people caring about it, is like an important part of the modern world. And so I think if science journalists aren't paying attention to it, who's going to? And, you know, I think it deserves attention because so many people are interested.
One of the last questions I have for you is kind of out of left field. It goes back to the beginning part of our conversation, but it's something I really wanted to ask you and I forgot. And after you had looked into this article where I talk about the copy and paste journalism, I think that that's what a lot of journalists do when it comes to the UFO topic. Let's say the New York Times breaks something, Politico breaks something, and they all copy and paste essentially the same thing, but they put it in their own words, republish it, and they're on to something else. On that note, where this kind of led to you and I meeting was that you went against the grain. You tackled the topic. You found out what you did for Major Harris. I believe that you were one of the first, and I mean, I'm sure that there were a couple more, but you were definitely the main and first one to really kind of come out and say, here's the truth about these UFO videos. I believe that was your piece for Wired, right? I think you wrote that for Wired. Yeah. The question that I wanted to ask you is, what made you go against the grain? Because it's not the popular option, even for a skeptic, even for an investigative journalist. You'll get more traffic. You'll get more hits for your named article, for your byline on whomever you're writing for, if you do more of a pro approach. We all know that. So you went against the grain and sided with, this is what you found. This was the evidence. May not have made you, all the clicks, as if you just said, yes, these are declassified UFO videos. They might be aliens, you know, with a flashy headline. But you went with that side against the grain. What made you do that?
Yeah, I think part of it is that I am a freelance journalist. Like, I'm a contributing writer at Wired, but I don't actually work for them. They're not my employer, and I'm not anyone's employee. And so I am not responsible for their traffic statistics necessarily. I could be responsible for my own fame or lack thereof, but I don't face consequences for not getting traffic, and I don't have the same kinds of pressures, and I also don't have the same kinds of time pressures that staff journalists have, where they just have to churn out a story a day or whatever and don't have time to use their credit card points to go to the Pentagon. And mm-hmm. I had that luxury, and also on top of having that privilege, I was genuinely interested on UFO Twitter. If you go on there, you'll learn that I hate UFOs and hate UFO people. But in fact, you know, when I read the story, I was extremely compelled by it and just had a deep desire to get to the bottom of it for my own. I couldn't stop. And I wanted to know the real story. So.
Well, good for you and compliments. I honestly, that's why I was excited that you were coming out with a book when I learned about it last year or whenever that was. I was excited to be a part of it. And then obviously really excited that you agreed to come on here and talk a little bit about your journey and diving into the world of UFOs. Obviously, this is not the end for you. The book is called They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. I think I know the answer to this where I say it's not the end. You're obviously still pursuing stuff. You say you got open FOIA requests, so you're going to continue writing about UFOs, safe to say?
Yes. I'm not dedicating full resources to it like I was at the time, but I'm keeping up with everything, crossing my fingers for those FOIA requests, and when I come across updates to things that I've written, which hopefully there will be, I will definitely help get them out.
Awesome. Well, the best of luck to you, Sarah, and for this book. Again, you can purchase it now. They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers by Sarah Scholes. You can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, right? Brick and mortar stores, anywhere major, any bookstore, major retailer, and so on, right? Perfect. And your website is www.sarahscholes.com. Sarah, thank you very, very much. I really do appreciate your time. You're welcome back anytime. I look forward to your next book, which will probably be out, what, next month, 2 months from now, maybe?
Yeah, something like
Something like that. All right. Well, good luck to you, and thanks again. And obviously, for those who are watching live, thanks for joining me on the live show. If you didn't know that we broadcast some of these interviews live, you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. It is absolutely free at www.theblackvault.com/live. If you want the audio version, just go to theblackvault.com, enter the site anywhere you find a link. On the left-hand side, you'll find all the shows. This is episode number 52 with Sarah Scholes. Make sure you download that audio, add those reviews to iTunes and anywhere you are listening. And Sarah, thanks again. Thank you all for listening. This is John Greenwald Jr. signing off. We'll see you next time.